You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
All right, we're going to be in Nehemiah, and we're going to do something new today. I am not going to put the text up on the screen because I didn't trust my eyes to be able to read it. I told my husband, I said, I don't think I can see that far, for God's sakes. So, if you have, and I knew this crowd, most people bring a Bible, right? We still carry our Bible. So I figure you either have a Bible or you got one of those fancy phones that you can pull up Nehemiah 1 on your fancy phone. If you don't have a Bible, look at the person beside you because more than likely they have a Bible, all right? So we're going to take a look at Nehemiah 1 as the slide says up there. Nehemiah, it's an Old Testament book. It's right before the Psalms. If you're not right before it, but if you get to the Psalms, you've gone too far, come on back. But before we look at Nehemiah individually, I want to give you just a real, real brief historical context of where Nehemiah is, his time period in the timeline of life kind of thing. So I think a lot of you are familiar with David and Solomon, right? They were the great kings, and from 1000 to 930 BC, they reigned, and Israel was at its glory and its height. After Solomon died, though, there's a civil war, and there's a divided kingdom. Let me see if I can do this. I'm so excited. Oh, yeah. You had Israel. I'm so excited. Israel in the north and Judah in the south, down there, right? God told them over and over again, if you disobey me, if you ignore me, I will bring someone to conquer you. And so the Israelites in the north, in Israel, they perpetually disobeyed God. And that's exactly what happened. Israel was conquered by Assyria in 722 BC. So God sent prophets, warned them over and over again. They ignored him. Judah fared a little bit better. But eventually, I believe it was in 605, the conquest of Judah was started by Babylon. And by 586, Judah was conquered by Babylon. And so God had spoken through the prophets, if you disobey me, you're going to be conquered. But if you obey me, if you call out to me, if you draw, I'll bring you back into the land. And when we get into Nehemiah chapter 1, that's exactly what we're going to see. We're going to see God at work bringing the Jews back into Jerusalem. And so here's Judah. And so when they were taken into captivity, they went all the way over to Babylon. But then what was happening, before Nehemiah, there were two groups of Jews that were going from Babylon back over to Jerusalem. We're going to find out that Nehemiah was actually in the capital of Susa, and eventually he is going to go over and go back to Jerusalem as well. So that's historically what's going on in this book. The book is written, 445 and 444 BC. Historically, that's what's going on. But in the life of Nehemiah, what we're going to find out when we read chapter 1, a little bit of chapter 2, is Nehemiah knew two things. He knew God was at work in human history. He knew God had made the promises through the prophets. If you disobey me, you will be conquered. If you obey me, I'll bring you back into the land. And Nehemiah had seen it happen, and he was going to be part of it. So Nehemiah knew that God had a plan to bring Israel back into Jerusalem, all right? The other thing we're going to find out that Nehemiah knew is he had a role in that plan. If you've read the book or if you haven't read the book, it's a great book to read. It becomes very clear that Nehemiah knows I have a role, and my role is going to be leading the people in rebuilding the wall around Jerusalem. So these are two things to keep in mind. There was a plan at work, Nehemiah knew it, and he knew he had a role in that plan. All right? Now, we're going to read Nehemiah 1-1 through 2:12. It's a short chapter, so don't worry, oh, good night, we're going to be here forever. No. All right? And so you're going to see these things where Nehemiah knows. And so, the words, so read it along with me. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, while I was in Susa, the capital, that Hananiah, one of my brothers, and some men from Judah came. And I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and had survived the captivity and about Jerusalem. They said to me, the remnant there in the province who survived the captivity are in great distress and reproach, and the walls of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are burned with fire. When I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. I said, I beseech you, O God of heavens, the great and awesome God who preserves the covenant and loving kindness for those who love him and keep his commandments. Let your ear now be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant, which I am praying before you now, day and night, on behalf of the sons of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the sons of Israel, which we have sinned against you. I and my father's house have sinned. Now, this is where he's talking about he knows God's at work. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the ordinances which you commanded your servant Moses. Remember the word which you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though those of you who have been scattered were in the remotest part of the heavens, I'll gather them from there and bring them to the place where I've chosen to cause my name to dwell. So that's what's going on. They are your servants and your people, whom you redeem by your great power and your strong hand. O Lord, I beseech you, may your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and the prayer of your servants who delight to revere your name, and make your servant, he said, make me successful today and grant him compassion before this man. Now, I was cupbearer to the king. As cupbearer to the king, what he would do is he would taste the wine and eat the food that was eventually going to go to the king. So if Nehemiah, then the king wouldn't eat the food. So obviously a very trusted position, very trusted position. So then in chapter 2, he goes on to say, and it came about in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now, I had not been sad in his presence. It was not a good idea to be sad in front of the king. Another capital offense. So the king said to me, why is your face sad, though you're not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart. Then I was very much afraid. I said to the king, let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire? Then the king said to me, what would you request? So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, if it please the king, and if your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. Then the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, how long will you journey? How long will your journey be, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I gave him a definite time. And I said to the king, if it please the king, let the letters be given me for the governors of the province beyond the river, that they may allow me to pass through until I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress, which is by the temple, for the wall of the city, and for the house to which I will go. And the king granted them to me because the good hand of God was on me. Then I came to the governors of the province beyond the river and gave them the king's letter. Now the king had sent me with officers of the army and horsemen. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about it, they were very displeased to them that someone had come to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. And I rose in the night and a few of men with me. I did not tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem. And there was no animal with me except the animal in which I was riding. So Nehemiah knows God is at work, and it's clear that Nehemiah knows he has a role. Now, if you had to describe Nehemiah's life at this part, what would you say about him? And I asked some other people this question one time. They said, oh, he was a great leader. Oh, he took a risk. Oh, and all these kind of things. But one word that they never used, which I thought more about, seems to be clear to me, is Nehemiah's life was disrupted. It was disrupted, right? Holy cow, it was thrown into disorder. It was interrupted. His world was turned upside down. His world was turned upside down. What Nehemiah shows us, and the two things we're going to look at this morning, is how was his life disrupted? How was his life disrupted? And why in the world did he embrace those disruptions? All right? So there are three different areas where old Nehemiah's life got disrupted. His practical day-to-day life, we're going to look at that. His emotional life and his prayer life. Those are at least three areas where Nehemiah's life gets disrupted. So let's look at Nehemiah's practical life. Hopefully, as we read the account, some things are already coming to your mind. How about where he lived? He was living in Babylon, and now he's going to end up in Jerusalem. I think it's roughly 800 miles. So where he lived got thrown upside down. His job, he was the cupbearer to the king. It would have been a very prestigious job. And now he's going to go be a servant leader with a bunch of these Jews. He has no idea how it's going to go, but off he goes. His position of respect, to where he's going to have to earn respect. Everybody would have just wanted to have been friends with Nehemiah, but he knew the king. Oh, hey, I'd like to be Nehemiah's friend. A life of relative ease to rough living. When you read the account, these guys are building a wall with stones, and the bad guys are after them. So half the time they're holding a spear and trying to build it. I think one time they hadn't changed clothes for a week or something. So we're talking some pretty rough living. And so this is a man who knew God was at work in human history. He knew he had a role. And what does he get? He gets a disrupted life. So his practical life is disrupted. It's a whole new set of fears and risks. Oh my gosh. And if you read the book, everybody's trying to kill the poor guy. His emotional life was disrupted. His emotional life was disrupted. Do you remember what it said when he heard about the bad news about Jerusalem? Oh, he just turned back on the TV set and started watching Ted Lasso again. No. He sat down and wept and mourned for days. His emotional life was impacted by the things of God. That Jerusalem was in disarray. Nehemiah understood the spiritual significance of the walls being torn down in Jerusalem. Yes, there was an issue of practical defense of the city. And the respect of the city was tied to the walls. But Nehemiah knew something else about the walls. He says it was not only because of the human needs in Jerusalem that he was emotionally upset, but also, and I think primarily, because God was being dishonored as long as Jerusalem lay waste. For Jerusalem was the holy city, the worship center God had chosen as a dwelling place for his name. That is the appointed place where the reality of his presence would be experienced in love and mercy by those who sought him. But none of this could be a reality while Jerusalem was in ruins and the temple services were inevitably disrupted. Nehemiah identifies with the quest of God's glory and praise. And it is this that prompts his mourning and his fasting and his praying himself. Nehemiah's emotional life was disrupted because he cared about the things of God, because Jerusalem laid in waste, the very place where God's symbolic presence would be. And so that is when he hears about that, he's shattered. He is shattered by the things that God cares for. And it's not just in that passage where you see Nehemiah's emotional life being disrupted. In chapter 5, verse 6 and 7, if you go on to read the book, there's a famine, and the Jews are charging exorbitant interest rates from one another. And it really makes him mad. Now, he's not mad because he's getting cheated out of money or anything like that. But it's like, how in the world could one brother use another brother? And so is the things of God, how could this community abuse each other like that. And so he gets angry about those kind of things. And he gets joyous, and at the end, when they're rejoicing and they're having a party because this wall around the city of Jerusalem has been rebuilt, they have a huge party, and that's what makes him excited. And on that day, they offered great sacrifices and rejoiced because God had given them great joy. And so you see Nehemiah, who understood God's at work, that he has a role, that how things are playing out in God's kingdom, how his role is being played out, it impacts him. And finally, his prayer life. In this first chapter, we see his prayer life is disrupted. Just think, he was fasting and praying and mourning for days. If I'm praying for an hour, I'm thinking, wow, woo, yee, man, right? Days and days. His prayer life was disrupted because of his great concern what God was doing and his role in that. And one thing about the book of Nehemiah, if you go through it, it lists, Nehemiah was this guy who was praying all the time, all kinds of spontaneous prayers. But when the prayers that are recorded in the book, though, when he prays spontaneously, he is asking God, Lord, help me to do the thing you've called me to do. Give me favor with the king so I can get what I need to build the walls. Here's some samples of those. In chapter 2, verse 4, when there's this spontaneous prayer, he's saying, the king says, well, what would you need? And he's already a little nervous about asking the king for something. So he prays to the God of heaven. God, give the king favor. Give me favor with the king so the king gives me what I need so that I can go to Jerusalem and rebuild the wall. So he asked for that. He asked for protection because there are a number of people who are against the wall, the rebuilding of the wall around Jerusalem. And here he is, hear, O God, how we are despised. Return the reproach on their own heads and give them up for plunder in the land of captivity. God, give us protection. These are bad guys. Get rid of these bad guys, right? So he asked for protection. He asked for courage and stamina. For all of them were trying to frighten us, thinking they will become discouraged with the work and it will not be done. But now, oh God, strengthen my hands. So even in his spontaneous prayers, they're directed to accomplishing the role that God has given him in restoring Jerusalem. So you might be thinking, well, so what? When you think about it, Nehemiah's life of a disrupted life reflects a pattern throughout biblical history. When you think about the main players, God, just about anybody that you read about, their lives have been disrupted. When you understand God's at work and I have a role to play in that plan, you can be guaranteed that your life will be disrupted. Think about poor old Abraham. Oh, good night. That poor guy, he's in the Ur of Chaldees just doing his own thing. And God says, go to this other land. So his everything was turned upside down. How about Moses? Moses, oh, man. Oh, that poor guy. He didn't, on many fronts, but when he doesn't like to speak in front of people, and he keeps telling God, well, I don't think I can do it. And God says, yes, you can. No, I can't. So there he has to go in front of Pharaoh. And speak in front of Pharaoh and challenge Pharaoh and then lead a million unruly people. I'm sure when Moses was 12, he didn't think, oh gosh, I'm going to get to go lead a million people who are unpleasant and aren't going to like me through the rain. Oh, I can't wait. It's going to be a great day. His life was disrupted. And David, oh my gosh, he went from being a shepherd to a king. And talk about an emotional life being disrupted. Read the Psalms. And the rich emotional life that comes along with David. The prophets, oh my gosh. Their emotional life, their prayer life, their day-to-day. Again, think about Hosea, who ends up, God has him marry a prostitute. Again, I bet you when Hosea said, I'll be a prophet, I bet you didn't think in part of this deal is I'm going to marry Gomer and wow, are things really going to get crazy. But think about Jesus himself. It's almost embarrassing to talk about our disrupted life when you think about Jesus. You know, even on just the, boy, when you read the gospel accounts, Jesus didn't even have a place to lay his head, right? You read the accounts and you talk about your life being interrupted. How many times do you read that Jesus is on this way and then somebody comes along and needs to be healed? His emotional life, how he weeps over Jerusalem because Jerusalem won't accept him as their Messiah. You know, I was looking at John 17 and even his prayer life. In John 17, it starts out, this is before he goes to the cross and the night before he goes to the cross and what he's praying about. Lord, my hour has come. And so he's praying, I want my life to glorify you and to accomplish the task you've given me, to go to the cross. So he prays for that, and then he prays for the disciples that, what? He prays that they're going to be able to do the things that he's called them to do. And then he prays for us, that we can play us. Yeah, he prayed for us, that we can play the role that he's called us to play so the world would come to know him. So even on the day-to-day life of Jesus, his life was disrupted. But then, again, it's just, I don't even know if this is the right, it's probably theologically the wrong word, but I really don't care. Think of it on a cosmic scale. Jesus and the Father and the Son had lived in perfect harmony for all eternity. All eternity. And at a point in time, Jesus made a willing decision to enter human history. And Philippians says he takes on the form of a bondservant, and he's been made in the likeness of man. So here is the God of the Creator, you know, like Colossians 1 that I think Gary talked about a couple of weeks, this is who Jesus is. He takes on the limitation of a man. And if that's not enough, then he lives a perfect life, but yet he's crucified, he's mocked, he's beaten, he's crucified. And again, that's only that. The worst of it, then he experiences separation from the Father for the first time in all eternity. Why? Because he loves us. He loves us. It's a love that we really cannot really comprehend in this life. And so Jesus knew God had a plan, right? Jesus knew that God's plan was to reconcile the world back to himself because of our sin. And Jesus knew that he was the one who was going to have to. Jesus clearly knew his role in this plan. And that was to die for us, to go to the cross. So talk about a disrupted day-to-day life and a disrupted existence on a cosmic scale. It's unfathomable. But he did it for us because he loves us. And that he desired for us to be reconciled. And he was willing to play an incredible cross. That if we're willing to ask that death on the cross to pay for my sin, for my rebellion, I can be reunited with the Father. And so here's Jesus who lives a disrupted life. And then it goes on. Then you got the calling of the first disciples. In Mark, he says Jesus is going by the Sea of Galilee. He saw Simon and Andrew, the brother of Simon, casting a net in the sea, for they're fishermen. That's what they did. And Jesus said, come on, follow me. So they drop their nets and follow him. And they're talking to James and John. They're the sons of Zebedee. Same thing. Fishermen their whole life. Jesus said, come on, follow me. And they do. So their familiar, their family life is all turned upside down. Their careers are all turned upside down. And so if you've chosen, if you know God has a role, he desires all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. And if you know that, you need to remember God, we're not our own. He's bought us with a price. And your life will be disrupted. You think, good night, get over it. But the last one I want to look at is Paul. Because Paul, this is Colossians. This is what Gary's been teaching. You're going to go back to it. We'll go back to that after Thanksgiving. Paul clearly understood God had a role. God had a plan that all Gentiles, everyone could come to know the Lord and have a personal relationship with him, not just the Jews, right? But he said, and I have a role. God has given me the responsibility of serving his church by proclaiming his entire message to you. I've got this role. And this is the message that was kept secret for centuries and generations past. But now it has been revealed to God's people. For God wanted them to know that the riches and the glory of Christ are for you Gentiles too. And this is the secret. Christ lives in you. This gives you assurance of sharing his glory. So clearly Paul knew and called. And guess what happened to Paul's life? It got disrupted, right? He knew. Paul thought, man, I've got this role to play in God's kingdom. I get to tell people. Wow. Wow. And just think, on the practical day-to-day, we could spend the whole forever talking about Paul's disrupted life. Good night. He went from the persecutor of the church to being persecuted, right? That poor guy got thrown out of more towns, beaten by more people, rejected by more people, hungry, had stuff to eat, nothing to eat. I looked it up. They calculate that maybe he walked 10,000 miles by foot in all of his travels, and it wasn't pleasant. I'm sure he didn't have Hoka fancy walking shoes, right? Or stayed at nice hotels. Wow. You think about his emotional life. It is hard to, as you read through Paul's letters, it is hard to miss his emotional attachment to the people he talked to and the people he tried to communicate the love of Christ to, right? These are just samples in Philippians 1, always offering prayer with joy in my every prayer for you. And Thessalonians, some scholars think he was only there for 3 weeks, but he talks about having a fond affection for these people, that he wants not just a fond affection, but I want to give you my very life. Galatians, right? Some of you are familiar with Galatians and the risk of the message of the gospel, of the free gift of God's grace being distorted, and the anxiety and the angst and his concern. You read it and you're like, you can just hear it in his letters. And lastly, we were studying 2 Timothy in our home church, and you can just hear Paul's affection for Timothy, how he longs to see Timothy. If Paul had chosen not to follow God's will for his life, he could have escaped all this, right? Boy, what a sorry mess we would have been without a Paul. And then his prayer life. Again, it's hard to read through his letters and not notice how many times he refers to praying for people. I can't even imagine how much time he spent in prayer. These are just samples, Romans, Ephesians, where the beginning of the letter, he tells them, I'm praying for you, always. And you know, in the same way that Nehemiah asked God for prayer to enable to build the wall effectively, you see Paul asking for the prayer, the same thing. In Ephesians and in Colossians, he's saying, Lord, help me to speak clearly. Help me to speak boldly your message. And often his prayers were for God's glory and his work to be done. You probably, you know, on one hand you think, good night, would you get over? We've got this point. But yet, I would argue, even though those of us who know Jesus, even those of us who know God has a role, that he desires all men to be saved and he has a role for each one of us, I would argue this perspective is so difficult to keep, right? We are, one, lots of different reasons. We all have our own reason, and if we had all day, we could all talk about them. But how easily distracted we are from the fact that God does have a plan, that he does have a role for us to play. So many shiny distractions. Holy cow. From stuff to entertainment to our own self, our own little thoughts about ourselves. We're so easily distracted from this basic truth. And our culture aggressively and unashamedly promotes our self-centeredness. Good night. Okay, anybody else do this? You watch the 6:30 news, and then you maybe watch a little Jeopardy, right? What are the commercials for? Think about yourself. Think about your finances. Think about your health. And there's 6 million trillion drugs out there. So think about yourself. It's all about you. Oh, boy. And maybe you watch, 30 minutes of TV in Jeopardy, and the rest of it are commercials unashamedly saying you need to think about yourself, worry about yourself, and it's all about you. It is so easy to begin to think what we deserve now is to be comfortable, to have it easy, another trip, another what you guys fill in the blank. But we all got it. And so what happens is if we're not careful, we begin to think life should just be pretty nice with an occasional disruption in my schedule. And then when the disruption comes, oh boy, do I grumble with the best of them. But you know, if you're around certain people, you don't grumble out loud because I'm too self-righteous to grumble that out loud. You know, like, oh, geez, right? Right. Boy, but what we miss out on. And so these are just a few questions to ask yourself to try to cooperate with God to see, Lord, am I losing this perspective? Am I missing out on what you might want to do through me today? Because I think life is really all about me and what I want to do today. And so these are just questions. And depending on how you answer them, it may suggest that you need to just go spend some time with the Lord and say, wow, I have just gotten swept up with what my culture is telling me and not what is true. So when was the last time that you can remember your schedule was disrupted by God? When was the last time you had your agenda set and it was a lovely agenda and along came the Lord and said, oh, by the way, I've got something else in mind for you today. And when your schedule was disrupted, how did you respond? I know how I respond. I'm not allowed to repeat some of the things I'm thinking, right? When was the last time your emotional life was impacted by the things of God? Our emotional life is impacted by all kinds of stuff. And again, I think a lot of us would be embarrassed if we had to list out everything our emotional life was impacted by. And there's nothing wrong with that. But do you have a category? Is there a time in your life where as you think about maybe Ethiopia and Lou and Dennett over there and the civil war is raging, do you ever stop and are you sad or worried for them? Is there even a category for something like that? And when was the last time that your prayer life was focused on advancing God's kingdom? Sure, absolutely. We pray about everything and we should. But is there a category? Is there a time where you're praying merely, I want to see your kingdom advanced? And Lord, as I pray for myself, I pray for all these things. But in addition to that, enable me to have the courage to tell my friend about Jesus. Enable me to have the courage to ask the difficult question for my friend. Are you praying for that as well? And if you can't remember the last time, then maybe you need to go back and ask the Lord, have I lost this perspective that you redeemed my life and you're a good God and you know what's best? And I'm going to choose to cooperate with you as you disrupt my life to advance your kingdom. So the last point, the time we had, why in the world would Nehemiah embrace these disruptions? His whole life, why would he do it? Why would we do it? Right? Why? Because Nehemiah understood that building the wall was a good work. He goes on to say, he says, it was a great work. He said, building the wall was a great work. Now, is there anything inherently in building a dirty, stinky wall in 445 BC? Is there anything that really would have made that such a good work? I don't think so. It was not glamorous or much fun. It had to be dirty, difficult. They didn't have those machines that do all the work. I don't know any of what they're called. They're just all those big machines. You just told your kids, look at that big machine there, Billy. They didn't have big machines doing the work. They would have had to do it on their own. They had people trying to kill them. So the work itself did not make it a glamorous job. And it was all kinds of additional stress because he chose to play the role God had given him to play, to rebuild the wall around Jerusalem. So why did he do it? It's because God had given Nehemiah the job. God said, Nehemiah, this is a good work. That's what made it a great work. And it made all the difference in the world. The giver, the value of the job is tied to the giver of the job. If I asked you to make me a pot of coffee, you might say, well, all right, but you're pretty lazy. Why can't you do it yourself? Right? Fair enough. But what if, What if you're a high state fan? What if Ryan Day said, hey, could you make me a pot of coffee? Because all the football players, the coaches are going to get together. We're going to talk football. Or if you like President Biden, what if President Biden said, hey, Kip, could you make me a pot of coffee? Because all the world leaders are going to come hanging out. You'd say, yeah, I'll be glad to make you a pot of coffee. Ryan, why? Has the job changed? No. But the giver of the job changes the nature of the job. And so God told Nehemiah, and Nehemiah understood this was a great work. Some of you may have heard of this gentleman named Robert McQuilkin. I think you may have, and as you hear his story, it may ring a bell. He was an author. He was a missionary leader. He was a college president. He was founder of two radio stations, so he was a mover and shaker. His wife, Muriel, contracted Alzheimer's. And he quit all of that to care for his wife. All right? And so someone asked him, do you miss being president? And so this is in the book, Love Walked Among Us. He says, I didn't sleep well that night and awoke contemplating the puzzle. Muriel, his wife, was still mobile at that time. So we set out on our morning walk around the block. She wasn't too sure on her feet, so we went slowly and held hands, as we always do. This day, I heard footsteps behind me and looked back to see the familiar form of a local derelict behind us. He staggered past us and then turned and looked us up and down. That's good. I like it, he said. That's real good. I like it. He turned and headed back down the street, mumbling to himself over and over again. That's good. I like it. When Muriel and I reached our little garden and sat down, his words came back to me. Then the realization hit me. God had spoken through the inebriated old derelict. It is you who are whispering to my spirit. I like it. That's good. I said aloud, I may be on the bench, but if you like it and you say it's good, that's all that counts. It changes everything, right? God has made us with a deep desire to know that we matter, that our choices are significant, that what we do, what we think, how we act, really, it matters. This truth that when God calls us to do something and we do it and he says it's a good work, we matter. What we do matters because it's not just Patrice asking you to. This is the God of the universe who's asked you to do these simple things. And when he asks us to do these things, he's saying, that's good. I like it. I know I mentor a high school senior, not always the most appreciative young girl. So I'm driving to pick her up and I'm grumbling like crazy. But I'm so grateful I got to think about this teaching because in my mind, I kept saying over and over again, that's good. It's a good work. It's not necessarily enjoyable. It's not much press. But God says it's a good work. It's a great work. And it changed my perspective as I did this little thing. And so it changes everything. All these are just little things, and you guys could come up with countless lists. That the lie that we want to believe is it's not important, it's who cares, no one will really worry, blah, blah. I don't have to tell you all the lies we come up with, right? But God says when you do these things, God himself is saying, that's a good work, that's a great work. And so that's why we allow our lives to be disrupted. Because we know God is at work to reconcile all men to himself. And he wants each one of us to play some small role. And when we play that small role, whatever it is, God says, that's a good work. That's a great work. And lastly, because I think the other reason Nehemiah could embrace the job God had given him is because he knew at some level it was a supernatural event. When the wall is rebuilt, this is what Nehemiah says, when the enemies heard of it and all the nations surrounding us saw it, they lost their confidence. Why? For they recognized that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God. Nehemiah just didn't look at the horizontal thing and say, wow, man, I'm a great leader. Look at this wall. Woo, no one like us. No, he says, God is at work. And this is being accomplished. And however they did it, the other people recognized there is a God at work. And so it's the same way when we do our little part that God has called us to do. And we understand it's God at work. Somehow the world takes notice. We're part of something supernatural. And lastly, when these guys built the wall, they probably were building it because they just thought, well, Jerusalem's going to be really trash and we got to get this wall built so that the city is safe and so that God's name can be glorified. They probably had no idea. They didn't. That Jesus was going to come and be crucified outside of Jerusalem. They had no idea that Jerusalem would be where the early church started. They didn't understand how God was going to use their little thing throughout all history. And I wonder sometimes how it might change us if we actually would stop and think, Lord, I have no idea how this thing's going to work out. But I believe, since you've called me to do it, and you're a good God, that someday I'll see in heaven how these little decisions, how I cooperated with you as you disrupted my life, how you used it for eternity. So, if you know God is at work in human history, if you know you have a role in that, you can be guaranteed that God wants to disrupt your life so that you can play a small role in impacting eternity. And I think that if we've ignored you, it doesn't mean you come right back at us and give us the opportunity to cooperate with you again, Lord. So thanks again for being here. Thanks for your faithfulness. And Lord, we look forward to Thanksgiving. Thank you for that time. Pray give us wisdom if there's with chances to tell our family about why we are so thankful. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.